Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Each episode, I'm talking to performers from film, television and theatre about one significant role in their career. It might not always be the role they're most famous for, but in each one, I'll be trying to find out about their preparation, the excitement and the sense of nostalgia that goes with any key role in an actor's lifetime. For many people, Jason Isaacs will be best known for his work as Lucius Malfoy in the Harry Potter films. But his list of credits in film and television is considerable. From The West Wing to Black Hawk Down, The OA to Brotherhood, he's worked with Ridley Scott, Neil Jordan and Paul Greengrass, as well as Matt Damon, Mel Gibson and Julianne Moore. He's played soldiers a number of times during his career. But I was interested to hear about one of the earliest, where he played the role of Frank Collins in Linda LaPlante's 1992's Civvies. I caught up with him at home and we talked about it. Hi, welcome to this week's episode of Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey, and my guest this week is Jason Isaacs. Hello, Jason.
Hello, mate. This is very, very strange. I have to say, admit a lot of trepidation going into this.
We'll be gentle with you. We'll be gentle.
It's not so much that. It's just sometimes, often, I think that talking about acting is a bit like dancing about fishing or something. Like, I don't know. I mean, I can do it because I can lean into my own, you know, how interesting I think I am and how fascinating the process is, as much as anyone. But some part of me thinks it's all utter bollocks. And the people I've been around who do it magnificently often couldn't begin to describe it for a second. And I'm not sure that I'll describe accurately anything that goes into what makes it an interesting performance. But I'll do it nonetheless.
We're going to talk about one of your early performances, which was in Civvies by Linda LaPlante, and you played an ex-para coming out into Civvy Street. But, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do the podcast was when I meet actors coming into the profession for the first time, it's so clouded in mystery, really, sometimes, and they don't know how to work on a film set. They don't know what's expected of them. You know, just mad things like getting an agent, getting into drama school. It seems like some sort of messianic sort of profession sometimes, and it's not. And I just wanted...
No, it's a craft. I mean, a lot of it is a craft. So I've been back, I don't know if you have, but I've been back to my old drama school and other places, actually, to talk to actors sometimes. And they sit there with their notepads, very keen, thinking I'm going to teach them something about acting. Well, I just work with a seven-year-old kid who's as good as I'll ever be in my dreams. So what I do when I do those things is I give them really practical things so that on the first few times on a film set, they don't feel like twats, just knowing who to ask about what particular things and what a mark is and whether it matters, what really matters. And I can see them hungry for me to drop some other Yoda-like pearls of wisdom, but I don't think I have them. But I do think you're right. When you first do it, you're not quite sure who to phone if you've got a question and just how to navigate when to come out of your trailer and, you know, who you sit with at lunch and really simple things about what a close-up means, the real craft of it. And that stuff I do think you can pass on. But the transforming into another person and how much to be or not be in the moment and, you know, how much you should or shouldn't judge yourself, how much you have an out-of-body experience or not, it's different in every job for every person every time, I think.
I think that's good, though. Even that, saying that, I think is brilliant, that there is no real sort of place that you will get to where it's always all right. It's different on for every person, for every job. For me, how I react to something on a Tuesday will be very different to how I react to it on a Wednesday, and that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
And there is this myth, I think, sorry to interrupt. There is this myth that we all, as young actors, lived with, which is that people who do it properly, you know, the Marlon Brandos or the Gary Oldmans or the Daniel Day-Lewis of the world, they really are Hawkeye or whoever it is they're playing. And we just feel like we're pretending a lot of the time. But you have to remind yourself that even when Daniel Day-Lewis is getting lifted into and out of his wheelchair and having his bottom wiped by people, he knows where the mark is. He stops when they say cut. He has lunch at lunchtime and he phones his wife, you know. So no one is ever fully in there. It's just how many different ways can you trick your imagination so that the other voices in your head stop. And as far as possible, you are that person whilst always being aware that you're pretending. How do you quiet down the voice that goes, you're pretending, and they all know?
But like with Frank in Civvies, which I saw. When did you last see it, by the way?
Oh, about 500 years ago. I can't bear to watch it. Yeah, I couldn't. I mean, I can't watch anything, even contemporary. But something that far back, I just think it's. I think it's horrible. You
know? So it's a real transformation because it's so unlike the Jason I know. It's an amazing piece. So watching it again, I was like blown away by it. Actually, from
I'm
your
sorry
point
you had to watch it. I apologize.
No,
thank
it
you.
Was great. It was great to watch. But also, you know, I remember because we're mates. I remember around about that time we used to always meet up and play football on a Tuesday night, and we had a big actors game of football.
And gradually that game stopped because when it started, people going, don't tackle too hard, I'm working. And then when it took more time, people putting the braces on and the Raljeks and the other different implements stopped getting injured. Then it started being just meeting in the pub and then people just didn't meet anymore.
Then we
withered. The game withered with us, I think.
We forgot about the football and just went to the post-game drinks, wasn't it? That was what happened. But I remember being on the pitch and knowing you and you just got civvies. And at one point I saw you sort of start to march up and down the side of the pitch in a really? Very different yeah. physicality. And when I watched civvies recently, your body and the way you sort of lean into your walk is completely different. So can I just ask you a little bit about, because I know later on when you did Black Hawk Down, you went and trained with
trained with the Rangers in Fort Benning, Georgia.
Did you do similar things with the Paras?
Well, I'm really going to expose myself here. So just plant this seed. This will come up much later. When my missus and I, it was then my girlfriend, were watching Friends back in the day. They had an episode about the freebie list, like who, if you came across, you'd be allowed outside the relationship to just shag because why not? And Juliette Binoche was mine.
Right.
So that will come back later. So first of all, I'm going to tell you how I got this job. So, you know, yes, it is a transformation for me. And I had always been that kind of actor that I was not comfortable being myself on camera. I needed to find someone else, probably why I was drawn to acting. I needed to find someone else to be, to release me from me. And I had that same day, I think, I had gone to audition for the series Soldier, Soldier. Oddly that, you know, some of those actors played football with us. Civvies. And Soldier, Soldier, maybe it was the day before, they'd phoned my agent. They'd go, look, he's really nice. But he's obviously not a soldier. He's a very nice, you know, well-spoken middle-class boy or something. And the casting director of Civvies had sent a message to my agent going, look, the director of this thing comes from documentaries. He's done one drama doc. He doesn't get acting. So if Jason comes in as his normal chatty self, he's never going to get the job. So tell him to come in far more in character. So I was unshaven and I went in the closest I could get to tough guy clothes, which I think was a leather jacket in those days. And I was kind of monosyllabic and I lied about, you know, many members of my family being in the armed forces. And I was deliberately a bit slower than I am in life. You know, I'm very quick to interrupt and to speak quickly and try and sound clever. And I did the opposite. I took a moment when everyone finished speaking and, you know, I looked like I was having trouble processing it. And then I answered slightly obtusely and it was like I was uncomfortable being there. And when I then got the job, in fact, I think they had a screen test. Linda LaPlante had found out, looked at other stuff and realized I wasn't who I was pretending to be and reacted against me. I think Pete Howitt, who ended up being the series, he also screen tested and one or two other people. And they all had to write down secretly on a piece of paper who they thought did best after the screen test. And they had all said me, thank God. But it was clear that I just wasn't that bloke or anything like him. And that's fine, because that's why I liked acting. But no one was comfortable with it. The director wasn't comfortable with it at all. He'd come
Carl Francis, wasn't it?
Carl Francis, he wanted authenticity and I wasn't that at all. So I phoned the producer and I said, listen, you know, I'm playing this tough guy in this series and thanks very much. I can't do a push-up, and I haven't had a fight since I was 12, and what can you do? So I said, I think I speak for the rest of the cast. I don't know them, but I'm sure we'd all love some kind of training. So she arranged a week in the Brecon Beacons with some ex-paras and SAS guys. And all the other actors cried off, said, oh, I'm too busy, or, you know, my mum's got a knee in plaster, whatever it was. There was only me and Eddie O'Connell who were left to go and do this thing with these bunch of guys who hadn't seen each other since the Falklands. The show was about people who had been in the Falklands come back and not be able to settle back in real life. So anyway, I went off to there. The first thing is that Eddie, wanting to immerse himself, said, all right, Frank, how's it going? And I went, no, don't do that, mate. It's going to be a really hard week. Just call me Jason. He went, all right, Frank, I've got your back. And God bless him, that was his process, but I was freaked out by it. And these men, SAS and paras, took us up the mountain. And because there were only two of us, and there were like five of them, they basically forgot we were there. And they pushed us way too hard. And we got to the point of fatigue and hypothermia and panic really early on. And we got to the top of a mountain and just shat myself. A very heavily loaded rucksack, a Bergen, blew off like a feather. And then we sat down for a minute to try and wait for the wind to die down. And they all started telling stories to each other. They weren't really there for us, but at that point they were. And one guy who, you know, should be nameless, but he was in the SAS, and he went out to the Falklands early before the task force landed. And his job was to create sabotage. So he was gleefully telling these stories about how he would kill people at night, kill as many people as he could at night. And then he would lie in a self-dug trench during the day, kept warm by the entrails of people he'd killed. And then he'd finish his story. And we're all, you know, my jaw was slack. They weren't. They'd all heard things like this before. They all told hair-raising stories. And then the guy in charge just went, you know what? It's too cold. We're going to double up in sleeping bags. And I had to spoon with him in a sleeping bag. Which I remember. And anyway, after 4 or 5 days of this punishing regime, in which they didn't mind the fact that I was pathetic, because they told me afterwards, look, the point was to break you down and see what you're made of once you're broken down. You were easy. You broke down in 10 minutes. It didn't take 3 days, but it was really about who you are then. We marched down the mountain, and there was the BBC folks there with a photographer, and they wanted to take our bags off us. And I went, I'll do it. And me and Eddie both did. We marched, we ran, we put the bags down. We didn't want anyone to do anything for us. So, you know, as pathetic as it seems, you know, we hadn't been to the Falklands, but we'd spent a week in the Welsh Mountains, or 5 days in the Welsh Mountains. And that, when you're acting and you're trying to draw on memories of bonding or adversity or whatever, it doesn't matter if, you know, you're meant to be playing a scene where you're in Rwanda and 1,000 people have been hacked to pieces and you're really only remembering the time your cat got run over. Whatever gets you there emotionally. So that was enormously useful emotionally. Us. But the physical thing is I asked another guy who used to play football with us, Doug Hodge. I said, mate, I've got to go and play a tough soldier, and my body's pathetic, it's puny, I look like Charles Hawtrey, and I've only got a few weeks. He said, well, I know a celebrity trainer, but I don't know if he'll take you. He trained Madonna and he trained Christopher Lambert for Tarzan. He really, you know, he only takes very famous people. He said, I'll give you his phone number, don't say you got it from me, and try and name drop, that might help, I don't know. So I phoned him up and he said, hi, who's this? And I said, hi, my name's Jason Isaacs. I've just got the lead. And I went into obnoxious boasting, you know, I've just got the lead in a giant television series. It's Linda Plum. I got your number from Madonna. And I know Christoph as well. And he said, you did amazing things with his shoulders and his strength. And he went, yeah, sure. So where are you? And I said, well, I'm in North London. He said, I'm in Notting Hill. Won't you come over to my gym? We'll have a quick look. So I go over to his house. The top floor had a glass roof. I remember that. And it was all a gym. It was empty. There was no one there. It was like one person in the corner. Basically, it was empty. And he said, so tell me the story. And I said, well, story is I've got to look like I've been a tough soldier for 25 years. I can't do a push-up and I've only got 2 weeks. And he said, blimey, all right, take your clothes off down to your undies. You're wearing undies? I said, yeah. He goes, take them off. He said, make muscles. So I stood there and I made muscles. He went, no, but really, really, like really like a gorilla. Don't be embarrassed. So I did it. And he went, yeah, 2 weeks. Like just march up and down the room, like really like you own it, like heavy, like a gorilla. So in my underpants, in my tighty whities, I marched up and down with my making muscles. And I got to the corner. There was somebody on this weights machine lifting very heavy weights with their leg. And they looked up and it was Juliette Binoche. And I thought, well, that one's gone. That's never going to happen, is it?
That was your freebie was gone from then
never
on.
Never going to happen. Anyway, so I did, you know, I did as much research as I could. Subsequently, I played soldiers many times. I spent more time with soldiers. But there is a military bearing. You'll know, I haven't done it yourself. We end up playing lots of coppers and soldiers. First of all, they stand symmetrically. Never stand on one leg with the other one slightly cocked. It's always symmetrical. hands often on hips in ways that are unnatural for most people. And shoulders back and hips forward, you know, this is so used to being on parade and very, it's not only their body set that way, but they want to project that. So, yeah, I think I probably did absorb some of that.
You did. And also, I think the other thing that comes across, well, many things come across watching it again, but that idea that you're always on, you are never relaxed because you've been in an environment for many years where something can happen life-threatening at any second. And when you come into Civvy Street, you don't just drop that. You still have this total vigilance in your body all the time. You're just held.
Well, it was before the phrase PTSD became commonplace. I don't know if it even existed then. But and so then people were saying things like shell-shocked or, you know, various euphemisms. And it wasn't really acknowledged by the British or any other army at that point, even though America had seen what had happened after Vietnam. And the people that I met, you know, Linda LaPlante wrote this about people she knew personally well, had tried to set up in a minicab business and it had all gone south for them. You know, there were a bunch of what was intriguing then and never went away from me in subsequently playing soldiers is how intimate these men were with each other, how they didn't try and be macho with each other. They didn't have to be macho. They'd been in the most alpha male environment you could be in. So on the one hand, they were capable of immense brutality, but also capable of incredible tenderness with each other because they didn't have to. It wasn't like people would get out of their car and have a fight or have a fight at the pub or something. You know, there were much bigger and more stressful times they'd been through. And so it was this dichotomy between how vulnerable they were with each other, prepared to be with each other, and the front they put up to the world and how they engaged with the world in this ultra alpha male way. And it was really eye-opening. But what was interesting about the series, and I'm jumping slightly to the aftermath of it being on, is that the public couldn't handle it at all. And the government were furious. There was columns in the Daily Mail. There were actually questions asked in Parliament how disgraceful it was. And of course, journalists went to serving soldiers and they went to the serving head of the military and they went, it's disgusting. They should say this about our soldiers. But actually, we were getting giant mailbags from homeless soldiers and soldiers in prison who sent a photograph. There were so many paras in one wing, they had a cake with the wings on it, you know, for someone's birthday. And so there was this, it was absolutely eye-opening that there were people all around us. In those days, it came straight back from war, straight back from zones where, you know, death, as you say, is around every corner. And expected to go to the supermarket and do the pickup from school and handle a marriage. They could, you know, the stories of the numbers of people who, you know, the wives woke up with their husbands with their hands around their throat or, you know, punching the walls and stuff. It just, now it's commonplace, but then I'd never heard of it.
And did you meet soldiers who were sort of on Civvy Street? I know you met the guys up in the Brecon Mountains, but did you meet people who were going through the D-mob side of it that you portray so brilliantly?
I didn't. I want to say I did. I have subsequently lots of times. I met them on Black Hawk Down. I met all the people who had survived, and so many of the people who had survived that night in Mogadishu. And then on Green Zone, all the people in the scenes with me that aren't Matt Damon are genuinely currently or ex-serving soldiers. And there was a big mix amongst them, some of them for whom they were the best days of their life. Some of them had managed to kind of managed to accommodate normal life. Some of them couldn't cope with it being behind them and were now doing private contracting work. But some of whom were broken, you know, unquestionably broken and damaged and dangerous too. At the time I trusted, and I was right to trust, Linda's writing. Linda captured perfectly something I would only see for myself years later.
She does a brilliant thing, and you all do it, which is that sense of these are the men that we created, and we're fine with them when they go and do our, which is always true. You know, it's like the Rudyard Kipling Tommy poem or whatever. We're fine when they're off doing our, you know, what we want them to do, but when they come back, we have no responsibility for them. And that sense of watching, I think what's, you know, there's a sense that Frank is a difficult character and does terrible things, particularly, you know, there's a sense of violence around his wife that's really unsettling. Yeah. But because we see that he is a damaged man that has been put into those situations and left
left to come back. I mean, there's an element to it that I understood then, and then I had confirmed on Black Hawk Down, and you know, I played soldiers like four or five times now, which I think the public don't understand and is slightly uncomfortable, which is that when you sign up for that stuff, You train for it. You want to do it. You're in your element when it happens. Now, you're not in your element if you die, or sometimes you see your friends die or you get injured and you wish you hadn't and it traumatizes you. But for some people, you know, if you train to be a boxer, you want to get in the ring and see if it works. If you train to be a footballer, you want to get on the pitch and kick. It doesn't matter how much someone pays you. A lot of people want to go to war because it's what they train for. They love getting there. They love being good at it. It's addictive. It has a, on some people, not all people, it has a damaging long-term effect. I mean, of course, it's, I read a lot about it at the time. I subsequently got to meet more people, but I remember reading about it at the time and that when people come back from war, it is completely natural and right and not psychiatric damage at all that they should be, have a period of time when they reacclimatize to the pace and lack of danger in life. It would be odd if they didn't. Now, if they're still doing it a year or two later and they're still beating up their wives or they're still, you know, freaking out or drinking bottles of whiskey a day, you know, if they get that far, if they don't commit suicide at the rates they do, then fine. But it is right to have a period of time adjusting because it would be unnatural not to. So I didn't get to meet as many as I did. I trusted Linda's writing. I've subsequently seen it confirmed for myself amongst the people that I know. But it just felt real. It felt right.
When you return to a profession again, so when you go from you've played a soldier here, then 3 or 4 years later you play another soldier, do you re-research or do you rely on what you've done in the past or do you just constantly accumulate a research around the profession?
I think there's a general understanding you have of warriors, people who want to be warriors and how they fight and what it's like being back in life. But when I was playing an American who had fought in that one night in Mogadishu, I needed to meet those people and see what that one night had done to them. Now, subsequently, America's been at war, and the world, but the Western forces have been at war for decades in urban warfare. It's a different thing. It does a different thing to you. So every time you try and get it specific, look, every time I always try and find one person to be. You know, the audience doesn't know, and I'm not a very good mimic, so I'm mimicking them, but they don't realize, you know. So the guy I played in Black Hawk Down was based on a particular guy who I taped, who trained us in Georgia, who'd had a bullet through the jaw, a bit like Jerry Adams, has spoken a very particular way. And in Green Zone also, I based it on someone around me. Everything. When I did a series called Brotherhood about gangsters, it was one of the Teamsters on the set. No, they don't know. I know. I've taped them. And
you're only taking an aspect of those people, aren't you? You take, there's a bit that you're adding from them into the character you're portraying.
Yeah, well, that's why when, you know, this whole thing about talking about acting, how do you approach something? You do everything. I love the research bit. I mean, I love when we get to shadow cops and politicians and plastic surgeons and pimps and drug dealers. And I love all that stuff because they tell you things that they would never tell a journalist. They wouldn't tell their own family. You know, they're just, it's like they've got free therapy. They get to show you things they don't get to show other people. But I splash around. There is no approach. Some people, I'm jealous of them, who went to a kind of method drama school, write a biography and do a bunch of stuff. I do everything. And it might be the way they walk. For me, it's often the way they talk. I start with a voice because I'm not comfortable with my own voice. I don't know what it is. I'm more Liverpool talking to you than I would if Hugh Grant was doing the podcast. I'd sound like him. If I was doing David Tennant, I'd probably be Scottish, you know. So I've got to find the way that they talk to start with. And then you never know what bits will work. It might be a phrase, it might be an attitude, it might be none of the stuff that you've picked up with them, but it might be. So,
you said that when you were younger that you would look at people who were, looked like they were self-confident, that they were happy in their skin, and you were jealous of them. And then you wanted to know how you do that. And then you got into a rehearsal room and went, oh, this is how you do it, by playing someone else. I mean, is there a way that, you know, are you more confident in other people's skin than your own?
Always. Yeah. I mean, Linda, once you get some anchors in the world, as you get a bit older, but also, you know, a family, and particularly when you get kids, you go, well, I know this one thing I know I am. I am their father. That is unquestionable. Everything else is always up for grabs, you know, who I am. And I grew up, you know, where you grew up in Liverpool, and then we moved to London, and I had multiple personalities, depending on who I was mixing with, terrified that the crowds would overlap each other. And still to this day, it's a social weakness that my kids will pick up if they're there, and I'm suddenly going a lot more Australian when I'm talking to Australian people or whatever it is, you know, and maybe even shifting my attitudes, hopefully never shifting into something I would be ashamed of afterwards. But when I'm playing someone else, I'm comfortably just them. They are, you know, or even if they themselves might be, there's a misconception, I think, that the public have, even my own family, I don't know if yours do, that acting is about learning the things that you say and the faces that you pull. It's about the outside. And anybody who even scratched the surface knows that acting is about building the 99.9% of the character that isn't in the script and that, you know, that is deciding what not to say and what they want the other person to say. So that's something that, you know, I am more comfortable, not more comfortable, that's nonsense, but I am happy when it feels safe when I'm there. I know I'm okay to be, you know, I like people to like me. You know, most of us like people to like us. I'm aware, maybe over aware, over concerned of what other people's impressions of me are. But often the characters I play are not.
Yes, that's what I was going to say, because you play a lot of people like that, and I do too, that are not likable. I mean, there's a sense of whether we have to like our characters. I often think, well, if I met him, I probably wouldn't like him, but I have to really have great empathy and understanding to this person to do him justice.
Yeah. Well, they think they're right. I mean, that's something that I, even before I was acting, even as an amateur, I was studying law when I first started doing it. And I think I understood early on one of the complex things of life, which is that awful people that I would think are awful, terrible people, think they're right. And growing up as a young Jewish kid, you know, the worst person that ever lived was Hitler. And I realized early on that he thought he was doing the right thing. And around him were many people who thought they were doing the right thing too, and they could justify it. So you and I have played a lot of antagonists, and I'm sure we're sick of being asked the question, do you like playing the hero or the villain? Because genuinely, I hope I'm not broke enough to have to take a part if he's clearly the villain to himself. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump looks in the mirror and thinks, they're all fucking idiots. Mm-hmm. I know what's what. And I know which race should be superior, and I know how to run things and how to talk to people. And if you spend a life of violence, being violent, violence being your currency, that's your first go-to in a situation of conflict.
I did do one film a while ago, and it will remain nameless, but it was a foreign company who were doing it, and after a day's rushes, I was playing quite a sort of complex evil guy. And after a day's rushes, the producer came up to me and said, yeah, we've been watching the rushes, and it's very subtle, very complex. We don't want that. He's just evil. he's just evil. And I said, okay, great, you know.
Sure. Well, look, there are people who grew up thinking the world is Darwinian. No one calls a lion evil at a watering hole for eating a wildebeest. They go, fuck it. You know, that lion knows I'm more powerful. I can eat that thing. I will. And there are people to whom the world is that. They go, if I'm stronger, I can dominate the weak. I can take what I want. The world is cruel. It's been cruel to me. Everything else is sentimental bullshit. And you can justify that too. But at least that person believes that they, you know, it lives within their own internal ethical, moral universe. And if it doesn't, there are people who cross it and go, I know I'm doing something wrong, but fuck it, I want what I want, and I'll deal with the consequences later. Yeah. It's when they're written not to do that. You and I have both been up for many similar parts. I'm sure you've ended up playing many I wanted and vice versa. But they think often, the people making films, that if you put you or I in it, we will bring some air of power or something sinister, and you won't. It's always the story that gives you that power. In fact, it's the other actors that give you that old Shakespearean saying, you can't play the king, you know. If you come on screen and you don't have any agency, you don't get to do anything bad and no one's frightened of you, I don't care how gravelly your voice is and how many faces you pull, you look like a twat, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been offered many of those parts, which I wish I'd done on a purely financial basis, but I just couldn't step in front of the camera and do that badly.
You said earlier that you were studying law and then came into acting. Was it a struggle for you to come into the profession in terms of its seriousness or anything like that, how it would be accepted by friends and family that you were suddenly going into a profession that was seen to be very different from the one you were studying?
Yeah, I mean, it was. My I don't know what class means anymore, but, you know, I come from... We were a family, if class is defined culturally, we were a very working class family. My dad was very poor. He left home at 15. He was an apprentice, you know. He made a bit of money, but we still, you know, culturally, we had a slightly nicer house than the other people who lived in council estates, but we just watched telly and no one read any books. And the thought was that me and my brothers would be the first ones to go to university and do proper jobs, do a job that, you know, you could actually have a profession. And my brothers did. One was a doctor and one did law, and I went off to do law. And, you know, the thinking was you do better than the generation before you. And I did this slightly pretentious, poncy, fun, arty thing as a hobby at college. But the notion that you might then dive into a world that was defined by people living in bedsits and eating out of, you know, pot noodles cans, it just seemed suicidal, you know, and an insult to everything my dad and mum sacrificed to send me to college. And so it was hard, but I never made that decision, weirdly. I thought I'd go to drama school, or I'd audition for drama school, first of all, because it was only 10 quid and it was a day out in London. It wasn't like, I'll go to drama school. It was just, that's a day out from Bristol. And then when I got in, I'm sorry, this is a story I've told before, but it is true. I'd never forgotten it. That I thought I'd get a letter that maybe I'd keep, and it would be on the wall of my legal chambers, or my grandchildren would discover it in the attic and go, Granddad, is it true you got into drama school? But instead, this amazing woman called Jane Cowell, who was this very tall, stentorian, kind of posh Julie Andrews type figure, who was a voice coach. She came out at Central after the recall and she said, we'd very much like to offer you a place in September. And I went, wow. And she went, I hope you're not fucking us around, young man. And I went, what? And she went, you know, thousands of fucking people apply to these places. And I was so, you know, I said, no, of course, that'd be amazing. And I walked down the street in Eaton Avenue in Swiss Cottage, where Central is, thinking, do I want this? Did I just decide to go to drama school because that's what I like to do in my life? Or is it because a really posh woman swore at me and I'm letting her make the decision for me? Like, do I want this? Anyway, I thought, doesn't matter. I'll go to drama school for 3 years. I can put off being a grown-up, and then I can do the proper job with, I don't know what it'll be, but, you know, I can go to the city or something, you know, make my family proud. And after 3 years, I thought, well, I've just spent 3 years. I better get a job in the theatre. I better do one professional acting job once. You know, I was offered a job at the Playhouse in Liverpool. And then I didn't go because I got Capital City and I went and did that. And I thought, well, I've been part of a small ensemble. It'd be great to be a lead once in something. And I was, and Civvies came along. And I thought, it'd be nice to do a bit of theatre. Yeah, but I've never been to film. And then all of a sudden, it's too late to do any other job. It's like, what am I going to do? I've got no skills.
And you've got.
So I never really made the decision.
So have you made the decision yet?
No, I don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up. I wanted to show you something because my missus has been clearing out the loft and everywhere else and throwing everything away and going mad on Marie Kondo. And the director of Civvies, Carl, who was very upset when he found out that I had a law degree and that, you know, and I spoke nicely and stuff, and felt like he'd been cheated. So, and he said to the Marini, the amazing makeup woman, he said, like, let's toughen him up because he's a poncy middle-class boy. I said, I want a bunch of tattoos and let's get him a chest wig. And she went, oh, Carl? He said, yeah, get him a chest wig. And I looked at her and she went, shh, shh. So afterwards she said to me, don't worry. He says, look, we'll get it made. It's stupid. He's going to change his mind. That's fine. So we went to the London Wig Company. Everybody turned up because they'd never seen anything like it before. And they fitted me for a chest wig. And I said to Carl at the time, I go, what a chest wig for? He said, oh, women love rubbing their fingers through your hair. It's sexy.
And I went, Tom Jones. It's all Tom Jones, man. Exactly.
I said, that's because you're bald, Carl. They haven't got a choice. That's the only hair on your body. Anyway, they made me a chest wig, which probably looks like a dead cat or something. And I turn up on set to do the first day we would see it in a vest, the shagging my wife or something like that. I mean, I had to shoot in prison with this thing. And he goes, there you go. That's good. That's a bit tough, isn't it? I went, no, it's not. It's a bit of hair stuck in my chest. You're mad. Anyway, I found a photograph from the fitting of the chest wig, which I thought I might show you there, which is...
It's very Borat.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I had to wear that. And we had to shoot in a prison one day.
Okay, I need to describe this for the listeners. So it's a very... It's an old Polaroid.
Sorry, I forgot this isn't a real Zoom. Sorry.
It's a Polaroid. It's quite yellowed. But it's you with quite a white body. And
very, very puny body.
And a dead cat. It's a real dead cat, right?
I mean, it's genuinely ridiculous. And when we brought it to the set, everyone's doubled over laughing. He said, yeah, no, that's good. That's proper. In fact, the first day we shot, the first scene we shot, I was doing the normal thing. I'd already been on set for other things for a while. I'd never played a tough guy, oddly. You know, it's the pivot around which my career changed. But I was chatting to people, making jokes. Pete Howitt was in it. It was very funny. And Lenny, who became one of my best friends. And, you know, we did one moment, and all I had to say was, let's go upstairs. Drunk in the kitchen, let's go upstairs. And he goes, cut. And he goes, come for a walk with me. And you have to bear in mind, I loved Carl. He was a very tough, irascible guy who wanted authenticity, and I don't blame him. And he was, you know, so we march up and down where we were shooting. It was appropriate. It was a toilet paper factory. So these gigantic rolls of toilet paper. And he went, I'm going to have to replace you. I've never had to do this before. I have to fucking replace you. But a fucking middle-class ponce on the act. They're all laughing at you. Everyone thinks you're ridiculous. because I made a terrible mistake casting you. You've got to be fucking tough. When you're going to fucking scared, you've got to command some respect from these people. You know what I mean? It's a fucking joke. So we went back in, and the next shot was me kicking the door open, drunk, to my wife and pushing her out of the way, which I did, I think, exactly the same as I would have done without this terrifying talk when my balls went into my mouth. And he went, "That's what I'm fucking talking about." And from then on, we were firm friends.
That is brilliant. But did you think I better stay in character when Carl's around or anything like that?
Yeah, I think I probably did a bit. I think I could sense it offended him. And I've had that since. So I stay in accent when I play American a lot. I know that everybody does that when you did The Walking Dead. You know, I know that Lenny's down there talking to Andy Lincoln about Spurs and they're talking in American accent, you know. but I always do that. And I did a film. I've always done it, but the end of last year I did this incredible film, or it was an incredible experience. Hopefully it turns out to be a good film, which is basically just four people sitting at a table talking. Two of them are the parents of a kid who died in a school shooting, and the other two are the parents of the shooter. And it's years afterwards, and the two parents have not got over it, and they need to meet the parents of the shooter so they can turn him human in their head, because otherwise, you know, they think he's evil and Satan. And it was 2 weeks. It was just crying and shouting and intensity and pain and grief. Fake, I grant you, but still you do it all day, every day. And I stayed in my accent all day, every day. I would speak to my family maybe for 5 minutes a day, if that. And I stayed in my accent. I stayed in my accent all weekend. I realized too late that I'd stayed in my accent. I'd started at a tennis club on the Sunday and they all thought I was American. Sorry. And at the rap party, I went, Jesus, I don't need to talk like this anymore. And I went back into this, which felt really weird and alien. This, I couldn't work out who I was. And my fellow actors, who I've become very close to, were furious. They felt, geez, they felt like I'd been an undercover cop. And they were angry at me. And they asked me to go back into what they said was my normal voice, because they felt like they'd just met me. They didn't know me. So, yeah, I think I probably did unconsciously stay more London and more, not more damaged like Frank was, but stay more that.
Yeah.
I think maybe we all did. You know, it's something you drift a bit. You don't become entirely the person. Maybe Daniel Day-Lewis, you don't become entirely the person, but you become a bit more like the person, just so that, certainly with the accents. I was talking to someone the other day about this, who says, I can't do it. I find accents really hard. And I went, that's why you do it all day. So when they say action, you're thinking, what do I want? What do I need? Not how do I pronounce my A's and do I roll this R?
We'll be back with more chat after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, you're listening to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Now, back to this week's episode.
But also it's a muscularity, isn't it? I mean, it's like if you would treat your body, you go to that trainer to go to the gym, that's what you're doing. You'd need to go to the gym a lot to get the muscles for your body to look good. Accents they have muscles in your mouth that have never been used in your own accent. So you have to keep them flexible and ready.
That's
for
absolutely
when
right. Well, two things. One is you want to be trying to get it as right as possible. The other thing is, whatever you do, you want it to be so consistent that in the moment when you're thinking, I need you to apologize, or I need you to be scared, or whatever the hell you're thinking as a character, you're not also thinking, oh, I've got that weird NG sound coming up, should I bounce off it? You know, you just don't want to think about it at all.
No, absolutely.
It was a bit more macho, the set. There was one of the people involved who got, it became much too macho, and some of the stunt stuff became dangerous. I was hit by a car slightly, and I think they went further method than I did. And it was one of the things Lenny and I bonded over, because I felt I was in some danger at some point.
But on that note, there's lots of times when we have to look after ourselves as actors, because you can get whipped up into the emotion of what you're doing. And sometimes you feel, oh, it's not great for me to just step back and go, hang on a minute, is this safe? Or I'm not too, and not even not about safety, but sometimes you might feel a scene is going to a place that you're not comfortable with in its storytelling sometimes. How do you make your voice on a set heard? I mean, it's as a leading actor, some of that is given to you.
Yeah, you have a lot more status when you're the lead, no question.
But are you, there is a time, isn't there, when we have to be involved in confrontation, whether it's with a writer, a director, another actor. How do you negotiate that sometimes around that?
How do we negotiate it in a friendship or a marriage or a supermarket? I mean, I don't know. It all depends on the people. I mean, there's no question that a set is a hierarchical place and the director is Pharaoh. So you can have a discussion, but at some point, if they go, no, you're doing this or you have to do this, you got to decide whether you draw the line. I mean, when it's your own physical safety, now I'm more established now. There was a scene, I remember, there's this amazing man, Terry O'Neill, who's in it. He's big and puddly and bodybuilder and 7 times European karate champion. And he's a legend, you know. This was the first acting he'd done, a friend of Linda's. And there was a fight scene. Terry O'Neill could crush me with his little finger, you know. But nonetheless, in this fabulous fiction I get to live in. By the way, anyone listening, there is a hammering next door. I can do nothing about it. It's not happening in your house. It's happening here. I'm sorry about that. I'm having a fight with Terry. It's in a stable, I think. And at some point, because he's 10 foot taller than me, I'm meant to pick up this bucket full of sand and smack him in the face. And Carl has set up the camera for a profile shot. Now, if you ever watch old cowboy films or any Bond film with the sound off, you can see often punches miss by a lot. And the way you get around that is you put the camera behind the head of the person who's doing the punching, or behind the head of the person who is receiving the blow. And that way you can miss them by 3-4 foot. And as long as they flick their head, it looks like. So Carl goes, it's a full profile. You can see I'm missing him with this bucket of sand. And Carl goes, you're fucking missing him by miles. Come on. And we had this, you know, I love him, Carl. So it sounds like I'm telling bad stories out of school, but you remember the fun stuff. And we liked to shout at each other. He was a very shouty guy. And I said, Carl, you've got the fucking camera profile. Obviously I'm missing him. He goes, don't fucking tell me how to direct. I don't tell you how to fucking act. I mean, just fucking get closer to his face. Well, there is no close when you're shooting profile. You cannot get close enough to do it. And I kept on getting closer and closer, and it was still missing him because it's a bucket full of sand. And Terry goes to me, because he's tough and his first job, he goes, just hit me. he says, just fucking hit me in the face. I went, mate, it's a bucket full of sand. It'll break your jaw. He says, I do full contact karate in arenas with like 7,000 people around. I'm fine, I'll roll with it. And I went, I'm not hitting you in the face, the bucket of sand. And Carl goes, he'll fucking do it. He doesn't care. Go on. I said, I'm not doing it. And it was a bit of a scene for a moment until instead of moving the camera, we angled ourselves around, and it was fine. Hello. Now it's coming. Sorry. We'll have to either pause. I'll tell him to Emma that we're doing a podcast. Darling. Yeah. Huge. I'm recording a podcast with Dave. So could you not? Would you mind? Keep it quiet. I am saying be quiet, but I don't want to be recorded saying shut up. Thank you.
We'll keep that in.
Yeah, I know you will. Yeah.
Go on. So you hit him.
So I didn't hit him full in the face with him, but there were a couple of times. Carl wanted authenticity. He wanted to make something real happen, a bit like Paul Greengrass. So there was the other one I remember. And Carl, if you listen to this, I'm not documenting the million times you made the scenes better with your energy and with the maleness, actually, he put into it. But, you know, he reminded us how to be macho in many ways.
But as you've got more experienced, how aware of the shot, how aware of the camera, how aware of the setup are you? And how much of that do you feel is your responsibility? I mean, I love that part of my job, I have to say.
Well, you've directed as well. That's a
yeah,
thing,
but you know. do you get involved in that? Do you feel that that's your responsibility as much as everybody else's? I know ultimately it's the director's, but is it a discussion that you want to be part of?
I like knowing about it, but I'm aware I've worked with actors who stick their nose in where it isn't their place to suggest shots or why don't you shoot from higher or lower? You know, you could cover it this way. And, you know, I think I've gone through phases where I thought it was my job not just to act, but to coordinate or manipulate everything else going on the set. And I passed through that to respecting that, you know, they've got a way they want to cover the scene. They've got a way they want to cut. I think that how you act in those contexts is... says a lot about who you are, how much you give off camera to people, for instance, mm-hmm. how much, you know, people who decide that they're not going to really go there until they do their close-up are not helpful to other people doing their close-ups. And if they don't do it in a wide shot, you know, people who, Mank that just is about to come out, that David Fincher will do 70 or 80 takes and not give notes in between to the actors. You know, it is right to do that. Going into the film, you know you're going to do that. I remember doing 121 takes of something with PJ Hogan on Peter Pan and having to be there every time. So, yeah, I like to know what the frame is because very early in Capital City, which was about city dealers, I'd gone and spent time with them in the city and they were all at the time doing tons of cocaine and champagne and buying Porsches with cash and all this stuff. And they all were twitchy. Everyone was twitchy all the time. Their legs were bouncing up and down. And so I was doing the bouncing up and down leg thing. And on about episode 3, one of the cameramen said to me, listen, mate, you might not want to do the stuff with your leg. You know what I mean? You're doing it a lot. And I said, well, they always do it. I've been down there because, yeah, I'm just saying that in the close-up, it looks like you're wanking. And I went, you could have told me that a few episodes ago. So I like to know what's in the frame. But I'm aware of that thing that you and I will remember. Maybe your listeners won't. There were some masterclasses filmed for television with various The Great and the Good. And Brian Cox did one on tragedy. And Mariah Aitken did one on comedy. And Michael Caine started it all off with one about just film acting. And it bred a generation of androids who don't look at you when they do their close-up and are trying so hard not to blink that they forget to mean anything or want anything. So there's a lot of people who try and make sure their close-up is as flat as possible to the lens, and that's just not necessary.
But do you watch the monitor? Do you watch the monitor on set? Do you watch playback?
Yeah, I do. Well, because I'm so often playing something so far from me that has an accent or, you know, such a completely different agenda from who I am. You can be unaware of what, you know, how what you're doing is giving the wrong impression of something, or you think that you're going through everything. And there's this thing about do nothing. You know, well, nothing is nothing. You can put a mannequin on screen. You're always thinking something and deciding to do nothing or holding something back, you know. And so sometimes I think I'm doing nothing and experiencing it all mentally and actually just look like I've had a stroke, you know. So I do like to watch it. Yeah, I do like to. And I also like to know, oh, I thought all that stuff was a bit of the story I'm telling, and it turns out it's not on camera. Until the camera reaches that point, you don't see me. So there's no point me having done the, you know, flouncing out the room or whatever the hell it is. I like to know what the camera is catching.
And do you get, when you watch the final thing all put together at the first screening or whatever it is, are you able to just hand this over then? Or does it still... when they've cut your favourite scene?
No, it kills me.
Is it?
I mean, I tell you the thing I don't like is when the scene is edited in a different order. And you go, well, if I knew that was coming after that, I wouldn't have done that. I would have done this, you know. You have to let it go because it's a director's medium and an editor's medium, which is the director, you know, by proxy. But the thing is to lose yourself. You're not a proper judge of yourself. There are scenes in which you think, I was feeling everything. My God, I've never felt anything so much, and it just doesn't come across. And there are scenes in which you're desperate to go to the toilet and you just want to get the takeover, and it, you know, it looks like you'd never been more bothered by anything in your life. And so you're not the best judge watching something of whether you're engaging or moving. I think, I don't know, what do you like to watch yourself? Do you do all that?
Yeah, I do. Not that I like it, but I think it's important. I do it less and less as I get older because of vanity. But, I mean, I think as a young actor, I would watch myself all the time, and I would have to watch myself a lot to get beyond the vanity, to get beyond the fact that I think, oh, is that my nose? Or, my goodness, you know, look at the state of me.
It's a fine line, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a fine line because not just Michael Caine, but there is this notion around of creating a performance. And there's a lot of actors I work with, generally younger people, who have so fully prepared the scene that you could drop your pants, spontaneously combust. You could do anything in the scene. You could burst out crying or laughing, and it wouldn't in any way alter what they're doing. And some of the very, very best, most engaging, most present, most honest performances I've ever seen have been off camera. And I include myself in that because you think, oh, I've got it now. I try and go last when I can, which is generally if you've got a lead in something, they think they do need the respect of going first. I want to go last. I want to see what other people are actually going to do, you know, when they, because I always commit off lens, but they don't. And then it gets me, I think, okay, I know the map through this now. I know what this scene is. I know what the people are doing. And then the camera points at me and I go, why couldn't I get there then? I've just been doing it for 12 hours for other people off camera. Why couldn't I reach those points? And it's because it's hard not to have that outer body, that third eye as well, watching yourself.
Yeah,
so
this, really
so that
hard.
Whole thing about looking at the monitor and just trying not to construct a performance, trying to think, what do I want? You know, the best director I ever had was not on film, it was on stage. And he would stop the rehearsal all the time and go, what are you trying to change? And I'd start answering, you're going, no, don't talk to me. Show me that you are changing the other person, that you are making them interrupt you, you are making them apologize, you're making them love you. So don't forget about yourself. And sure enough, that's what I see when I see people off camera and myself doing proper work that is fully engaging, is focusing on the other person in the scene. That's what will free you, you know.
Definitely. And in nowadays, in episodic television, it's quite rare to start a big TV show and have all the scripts. Do you get involved with the projection of what's going to happen? You know, we might have in a 10-part season, we might have episodes 1, 2, and 3 to start with. Are you getting involved with the writers and the showrunners at that point about the Bible going forward or character projection or anything like that?
Well, who wouldn't want to? I mean, in principle, because, you know, if you did a play and you're only given the first act, I mean, you know, our job as an actor, if we're lucky and given the controls, is to shape the revelation of this story, both the pace of it, the surprises of it. They don't always exist. And I've been executive producer or producer on some of the television stuff I've done in the past. And in some of those instances, it was genuine. They did open the doors. I was thoroughly involved, rolled my sleeves up. Even one or two I'd helped to generate at the beginning. And then there's times when they gave me that credit because it was felt to be appropriate for whatever my agent managed to, but they didn't really mean it at all. They didn't want me anywhere near any of it and they resented it. And I sensed that early on and backed off because it was just creating tension. I love to be, I do think there's a young actor I'm friendly with who's always at the moment furious about these terrible scripts and this fucking idiot who's directing and he's driving himself mad. He's just, you know, and I feel terrible for him because I remember being like that. I mean, I've got so many friends who are writers, directors, and producers, and, you know, we all have by this age. Everyone's doing their best. You know, they're doing their very best to do their very best. It's hard. Writing is hard. Directing is hard. Producing is hard. So I think I've probably got less, you know, I've wanted to dive into it and fight my corner less as time's gone on. I did learn very early on the Capital City, my first big television series, that once you start writing notes to people, don't even think it was emails then, and they get circulated around in many different colours, many different people, the creative process is dead. You know, so you're better off thinking, just wait, not to hold the setup, never to hold shooting up, but who is the person I can actually have a conversation with that doesn't seem confrontational, that seems creative? And often it's you can waste a million words when you just on the set go, how about I look there, or we lose that line. And they look at it. If they're good and they're empowered, they go, yeah, that makes sense, or that doesn't work for me. And so I think I used to do stuff with words and now I want to show it more.
And when you went from the UK to the US, was there a big difference there in their working process?
Fuck yeah. Did you not find that on the working day?
I did.
It's a different universe. It looks the same from the outside. My lesson was learned very early on. I was on the West Wing. I was living in America and I did a few episodes of the West Wing, one of my favorite TV shows. It had won... By then, the actors had won, I don't know, a million Golden Globes and Emmys. They were just amazing. And the writing was, it was all amazing. And I was so thrilled and starstruck to be there. And I was doing a scene with the great Brad Whitford, who played Josh in it.
Yeah.
Incredible actor, playing an incredible part. And we did this scene and I made a joke of a line. I made it sarcastic. I kind of said the line as if it was in inverted commas. And it was, you know, vaguely witty and funny. And so he said to the, again, multiple Emmy-winning director, he went, well, I can't do this next line because it's making fun of Jason, but he already made fun of himself. So it doesn't make, and the director goes, yeah, let's just lose it. And the writer came storming across the set and went, what are you saying? And the director, you know, said, well, this line now doesn't work because Jason made a joke, so it's fine. We can just move it. We'll just lose it. And he went, well, I want to see it. I shoot it. I want to see it. I'll decide in the edit. And I'd never seen the power structure in that way. You know, the writers on, well, there were no writers on British television when he did it. They weren't around. He certainly didn't have showrunners who had power over the director and the actors. And it was an early lesson that American television is a very, very different beast. And, you know, by the time the script reaches you, it's been through a dozen pair of hands, all of whom get paid seven-figure sums, and they don't like to be contradicted or second-guessed.
Yeah, and also, the whole thing is on the line, isn't it? Their careers are on the line. I mean, when I first did The Walking Dead, I remember after about two or three scenes going to the director, I had to go and find him. I didn't know where he was. He was somewhere else. And I said to him, are we okay here? Is this okay? And he looked at me like I was, you know, some madman asking him this question. And he was like, yeah, you know. And then I had to go and find the showrunner. And
The real power.
It was that thing you said before about who has the power to sort of change.
Yeah.
Who is the person who is given the power? And that can, in each film set, I have to find out who that is. And sometimes,
but isn't it weird?
Sometimes I find out it's me.
Don't you find it weird that sometimes, whether it's on film or television, there is a script written by very smart people that has been through all kinds of development, many people's approval, it's finally got to the stage where you're on set, and they've missed something that makes no sense whatsoever. But if you point it out, you know, there are ripples, but people will be embarrassed or caught short, or someone should have picked it up, that it makes no sense either emotionally or literally logically for the story. And then there's that awful phrase that you hear sometimes, particularly from directors for hire for the week, you know, who really don't want to be phoning the head office, and they go, well, if they're thinking about that, you know, we're doing something wrong. You go, they're always thinking about that. Whatever the thing is, that's always the thing they're thinking about. And I'm amazed that it happens. And it happens, I think, because scripts in the end mostly are Frankensteinian. There's been a dozen versions of them. And, you know, the people who are pushing them across their desk are also doing a dozen other shows. And sometimes it comes right down to the blunt end when you're about to say it and you go, why would I say that? I already killed his dad or whatever. And you try not to, you're trying not to insult anyone, but in the end, only you knows your character and your journey.
That's essential for me. I think you're there to look after your story and your line as much as you can and with the information you have. And sometimes the people, the powers that be, the growing ups who you trust with everything, they're looking at the whole picture. They're not necessarily looking at your through line. And I think it's always all right. One of the things I learned very early on, it's always all right to ask something and people explain it to me like I'm an idiot. I don't mind them explaining it to me to an idiot as long as I'm making them think of my through line.
Yeah,
and quite often when I've questioned it, they've gone, oh yeah, we didn't know that. Because they've missed
it. Well, there is this thing, isn't there? Because we're actors and in the end, we're hired to do the thing. And when you see something and you go, this is bad, this is wrong, I wouldn't tell that person, they already know. You're not actually able to go up and say that because that's just rude. So you have to phrase it like you're an idiot and you don't understand. And explain to you, you don't really mean that. You mean, this is wrong, it should be something different. Mm. And you have to go up. Just like directing an actor, if they get something wrong. I've taught directors as well, and I go, if you approach an actor and you say, start a sentence with don't, you will never get the performance you want. Mm. If you tell them, don't, I don't, that's too much or that's wrong, they're just thinking, how can I not get things wrong? Give them something to go for. Mm. Give them something to hide. You know, in the same way as an actor, if you go up and say this is wrong, immediately it's the wrong tone. So you have to phrase it. But have you not found through your career that there is this fine line always to be walked between, you know, I want to curate this and make sure it's the best version of my character, at least if I can't, you know, have effect on the story. And I don't want anyone to be at dinner somewhere else and go, he's a bit of a pain in the ass, though. He's always fucking stopping and asking questions. So there's a, you know, I earlier on was always questioning things. And now I still have those same instincts. And I just don't do it as much because I can see other people have difficult days. And I don't want anyone to go around and go, yeah, it's, you know, it's not worth it. You're always
I'm now at the point where if anybody's talking to me at a dinner party, I don't care what they're saying as long as they're just mentioning my name. But when I was a young actor, the first thing that it clashed with me was I was playing a policeman and I went and spent a lot of time with coppers who were my rank that I was playing. And I felt very responsible to these guys. Because they'd let me into their lives. They've been very sort of open with me. They told me all the things they hated about police dramas. Mostly it was about that you never see the paperwork, and I sort of understood why you never do, because it's not
very important.
Things like that. And then I got to my to the set on the first day, which was at my house, my character's house, and it was massive. And I said, sorry, but why have you chosen this house for him? You know, is he on the take? It's like, he's the only breadwinner.
Yeah,
his
yeah.
wife's not working. And they went, no, it's just a nicer place for us. And I went, yeah, but it says immediately the wrong thing about my character. He would never be able to live in a place like this. And it really annoyed me. And from then on, I was like, I got very nosy. From then on, I would say to designers, so what type of house is he? What car have you got him driving and stuff like that?
You're after authenticity, and that's not. There is a version of the police that we have on telly that bears no resemblance to any of the policemen who have opened up their lives to me. None of it, procedurally or culturally or anything. I've just never seen accurate policing. You know, I shadowed some homicide detectives in Los Angeles for a series I did called Awake, and I went to the costume designer and I said, "Look, first thing, let's talk about what we're wearing, because." You know, they wear non-matched suits they buy cheaply for work, because they're sitting in shitty cars and shitty houses and terrible places, and then they change to go home, mostly into sportswear. And she went, well, the other actors are wearing Armani. And I went, what? She goes, well, they're wearing Armani. And I went, well, that's ridiculous. She went, well, it's up to you. You can wear horrible, you know, non-matching suits if you like. You are the lead. We want you to look good. And I went, all right, well, just the lower end Armani, maybe, you know. And that's true. This is why... You know, when you do, somehow I felt with soldiers, both in civvies and in Green Zone, you know, the way Paul works, and in Black Hawk Down too, there were, you know, these were recent conflicts and these were real people watching it. And the people we're making the show about will be watching it from, whether they're in a house or a homeless shelter or prison, or they'll be watching it. When you play real characters, I was playing an actual real person, but when you play real people or, you know, a real situation, you do feel that responsibility to do something different, because you know that person will be watching you, or those people are watching you, and it can be frustrating when the cliches are reached for instead of the truth. But it's unless you've generated the show, or unless you have a lot of sway in the show, and everybody is on the same page of we're reaching for authenticity here, you have to give it up, because that way madness lies.
What do you think? Just from your persona as a leading actor, what do you think a leading actor needs to do on a set in order to set tone and stuff like that?
I get older, I don't know about you, I open scripts and I go, I don't know, I think I'm not sure. I'm a bit old for this part. My agent goes, no, you're the dad. I go, oh, right, I'm the dad. Oh, well, so that responsibility is off me now. I think we do this thing which has a serious place in the world and can be important, and more, you know, the less people listen to politicians and scientists, the more narrative fiction provides people with a template or even a life raft at, you know, times when they feel isolated or alone. But nonetheless, you know, we're not at the sharp end of the healthcare industry or down a mine or teaching. You know, it's got to be fun. It's fun, even playing very serious scenes. It doesn't mean you've got to be clowning around the whole time. But there is no excuse for behaving like, you know, for bullying and shouting and the tension. There's a lot of directors I've worked with who think if the scene is tense, you've got to create an atmosphere of kind of terror and tension on the day because they want to feel it. Well, we're actors. You know, we don't have to be in love to play in love, and we don't have to have a horrible screaming atmosphere of machismo in order to put that in front of the camera. And so my responsibility is to make sure that everybody is free enough they can do their best work and has a good time. And I like to play music if I'm the number one on the call sheet. And I did that on a couple of series I've been on. And the directors have come in and sometimes and go, look, the crew aren't comfortable. And I go, mate, I know the crew. They're all friends of mine. They come to my house every weekend. We love the music. You're finding it a bit stressful, and I'm really sorry, but that's what we do, so we can tap our toes, you know. And I just like the other actors to feel like, even though it's a lie, they've got an infinite number of takes and nobody's watching them, nobody's judging them. You know, if you do it right, then even if somebody comes into that atmosphere who is normally authoritarian or works through, you know, discipline and fear, they can't, because you've just you've built up an immunity to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, when possible, I try and make sure that everyone realizes we're incredibly privileged to do this rather silly thing that sometimes has value in the world.
Absolutely. I think that's true. And I think it's just simple things sometimes, like turning up on time, sort of making sure you say hello to everybody, you know, so it sounds easy that, but sometimes I've worked with people who just don't do that.
I'm a bit shit at names. How are you with everyone's names on the crew?
I'm great, George. I'm really great. No,
I get to wear badges. If I care, I get people to wear a sticker and then they lose it after the first day. And I go, mate, I need it for a week. I'm really sorry.
I'm like lions with names on the film set. I'll know your name, and then if I bumped into you 2 days after the job had finished, it's gone.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know who you are. But lastly, before we wrap up, I just want to ask this, because this is really important. It's about rejection. It's about not getting roles. It's about critics, things like that. Have you grown a thick skin to all that now? I mean, did that really knock you as a younger actor?
But it's all changing as we get older. I mean, you know, because there are fewer parts and they are not the lead and it's less money. And so, like, everything shifts. It doesn't shift for the directors or the agents or the writers, but it really shifts for an actor. So that's a thing you have to process. And, you know, I think it relates to the bigger thing in life of how do you wake up every day and train yourself to be grateful for what you've got instead of resentful for what you haven't. And that applies whether you've got loads or whether you've got nothing. Now, there are people with virtually nothing. I've met, you know, we started off talking about soldiers playing soldiers. So I've been privileged to meet lots of. If you meet someone who's lost both their legs and they managed to live their life. So they're incredibly grateful that A, they're alive, but they've got their arms because their mate lost both arms. And the ones who lost both arms, if they lucky enough and I don't know, magnificent enough to think themselves through this, they're grateful they can still see and hear, you know, and have no limbs and stuff. And so, you know, I've got lots of stuff materially compared to other people, which is an incredible privilege. And I've also got, you know, a family and my health and all this stuff. And I find it easy. Our profession is one where other people's success is in your face because it's not just in the back of your head. It's on the side of a bus or the cover of a magazine or whatever, you know, or on telly. I don't do it perfectly, but I know what I'm reaching for and I do it imperfectly. I can find myself, like anyone in any profession, thinking that other people's lives are much better, either their personal lives or their professional lives, their financial lives. But at least I recognize that that's an unhealthy instinct and I have some tools to go to. First of all, alarm bells that go off, so I don't go too far down the pit, and then some tools to correct back to trying to make myself grateful in the day. And the really basic ones before you get to anything more advanced are sleeping, eating, exercising. Those things will keep you some way in whack. And then trying to value, I'm not going to try and paint myself like Mother Teresa here, but because we're actors and we have a bit of a profile, we get asked to do charity things all the time. And as many as I can do, I do to remind myself that, you know, not because I have a big heart, but to feel better about myself and I guess in some ways to remind myself how lucky I am because I get to come in contact with people who, you know, I do a lot with the Red Cross and like, you know, there are so many people in this country who are come from unimaginable horrors and had a medieval journey of torture to get here. And now are here trying to live on £5 a day and are living in limbo. And, you know, so just making myself be of service and in contact with people with less goes some way to redress resentment, you know. Bad reviews, oh, fuck it, I don't know how you get over that. It stings. You can read a million people telling you're amazing and one person telling you you're shit, and that's the one I have no advice how to get over that. But the other things, you know, we all should get out of bed and try and find. It's easy for me to say, as, you know, it's easy for people point the finger, easy for you to say, you've got food in the fridge, and they're right. You know, I think poverty makes people unhappy and financial insecurity makes people desperate, but still, the only way to get through it for everyone, for me at least, is to try and find what I'm grateful for. And I may not get the jobs I want, but I do get jobs. Mm. You know, and if I ever start moaning about it, shoot me. Mm. It's like those people, don't you hate on set? You're on set and some fucker's going, I can't believe it. You know, they called me at 11 o'clock, didn't use me till 2. It's sitting in my trailer, you know, my heated or air-conditioned trailer with internet and people bringing me cups of tea where they got me from my 5-star hotel. And I've had to sit here for 2 hours while all these other poor bastards who've been here since 6 in the morning have to pick up my dirty underwear and don't earn what I earn in per diems. Shut the fuck up.
I remember being with an actor who was complaining about a job he didn't get because he was on the job that he was doing with me. And I was
That's very funny.
Oh, thanks a lot. Jason, yeah. That's been so great to talk to you. Go back and watch.
Who's doing this to you? Can I come back for one episode when you're ready, when your producer Simon's ready, and do this to you?
Of course,
it was my idea this time. I hate talking about how I act or what I do. I don't really know
you can, but I'm hoping in this season that I am offering up my experiences as well as
you
we
are,
go
but
along.
To take one particular part and dive into that.
Oh, yeah, we could do that. Yeah, let's have a look at that. I have to think about who that is.
Let me ask you this one question to go away with.
Okay.
If a plane went down tomorrow and I was in it,
yeah.
First of all, I hope I don't have to get on a plane tomorrow. But if a plane, they go, the actor who played Lucius Malfoy died. And, you know, you and I have been doing this for 30-odd years. Mm-hmm. You since you were a kid, me since I was a young adult. And I don't mind that. It's fine. I'm happy to be in this moment. If a plane went down tomorrow, they'd probably say the governor from Walking Dead, I guess. Although you've done millions of fabulous, you know, iconic parts.
No, what they'd say probably is that guy from Men Behaving Badly has gone down in a plane. That's what usually happens to me.
Is there any part of it that bothers you? You've done this enormous array of parts, you know, both sympathetic and unsympathetic, and you continue to do them in varied media, and yet you would be defined by this one part.
No, not at all. I'm so grateful to have done that part in that play. And actually, it's a huge part that people identify me with. But I have enough other stuff in my life that people come up and remember me. I've recently just released a Blu-ray of One Summer.
Oh, I saw. Yeah, I don't know if this belongs to the podcast or not. It may be that I ended up an actor because of One Summer. No, I don't know, genuinely, and I'm not saying it to be cheesy, because there are, you know, various different things. I can't play pop psychologist on myself too much. I don't know why and how I drifted into this thing. Could have gone a million ways, but I'm from Liverpool. I was a kid. I was a teenager. I went to school with your co-star in One Summer, Spencer Lee.
Yeah.
And this was someone I knew, and then he was on telly with you, and they were telling a story, and it was incredibly compelling and great. And I think it might well have lodged itself in my brain that it is possible to go from this strange little insular, you know, Liverpool Jewish community that I came from, which was a tiny, tiny bubble. And there were people who did things in the arts. And I'm not sure I ever forgot that. I'm not sure, I think it might well have planted a seed that came to fruition years later.
You're to blame. You and John Sim have both said to me, when I was a kid, I watched you and that's why I became an actor. So
I think it might well be in there as part of the reasons. Well, so, you owe me a life of comfort and security.
The world can blame me. Listen, mate, thank you very much. That's great. Go back and watch Civvies, because honestly, particularly what you were talking about with the PTSD thing, I thought this is revolutionary.
I'll tell you, there's a thing I did that if anyone's listening, they might want to watch rather than Civvies. There's a thing I did that left such a profound impact on me. And maybe, I don't care whether people watch the things I do, but in terms of the things I will remember that I did, it's called Scars, and it's on Vimeo. You can find it on. And it was a man who normally makes documentaries who had interviewed a very violent person who had spent a life of violence, grew up around extreme violence, perpetrated extreme violence, who he asked, this documentary director was starting to make drama docs. He said to him, can I talk to you about violence in your life? And we won't use any details at all of anything you tell me, but as to inspire a script, I might improvise with actors. And he started to interview him, and they didn't stop for a year. And during the course of it, this man had essentially a nervous breakdown as he relived the things that he'd buried in his traumatic past. And when Leo, the director, put together a script, Channel 4 went, I don't know about the script so much, but the interviews sound interesting. And so I acted out verbatim, just a tiny slice of these interviews of a man steeped, born and living in violence. And it haunted me. It was a monologue because we were just recreating these audio interviews, but on camera. And I've never had anything take me over so much, terrify me so much. Terrified for my kids living in this world, knowing there were many people like this walking around, sitting on this volcanic and dangerous, disruptive energy, and prepared to do violence with the slightest call. But so if people want to know what PTSD is, they should watch that, not Civvies. They should watch Scars on Vimeo. And that's a real guy. It's his words exactly. And it's an insight into what happens when we don't get in early enough and help kids out of environments like that.
Well, on that note, we will go.
Thanks, mate. Cheers, mate. See you.
Who Am I This Time? Is a Just Voices and Doolally production. Produced by Simon Lenigan. Music by Greg Hatlow. Edited and mixed by Russ Keffert at Audio Egg. And presented by me, David Morrissey.